Rav Yitzchak Bratowitz Shlita is the Rav of the Woodside Synagogue in Washington, D.C. and a professor of law at the University of Maryland. It's like a Pavlovian response with you people. He has lectured extensively throughout the United States and Israel on medical, business, and family ethics. He has published numerous articles on bankruptcy, commercial law, medical ethics, family law, and halacha, including articles on the desecration of ancient burial sites through archaeological excavations. He also spends a lot of time on stem cell research and brain dead research as well. Been involved in NCSY for over 30 years. NCSY regions, regional directors, and Rabbanim have turned to Rabbi Bratowitz for a range of questions to get clear and Torah-sourced responses. He received his rabbinical ordination from the Yeshiva Rabbinical College in 1976, his Bachelor's of Science with honors from Johns Hopkins University, Magna Cum Laude from Harvard Law School in 1979, and a doctorate in Talmudic Law from Ne Yisrael in 1992. We have with us, Baruch Hashem, the best of the best. The format's going to be as follows. For the sake of clarity, and also for the recording, I will ask all the questions. Originally we thought that you'd be able to ask them, but I think it'd be better for the format that I'll ask all the questions. The rabbi has not seen the questions in advance. The rabbi seems quite relaxed. I'm nervous. I've tried to put the questions in some sort of order, but I'm not sure if I've succeeded in that. Without further ado, Rav Yitzchak Bratowitz Shlita.
Well, good evening, everybody. It's a real pleasure to see you. This Yarchei Kala really is one of the highlights of my year, as I hope it is. As hope it is for you, for people, for really, how many people are there? Over 100 to come together and to learn Torah for a whole week when you can have a vacation and do what you want is really a tribute to your Jewish neshama and the spark of holiness that is within each and every one of you. And I think all of us can take a tremendous amount of inspiration in terms of raising our own level of Yiddishkeit and the learning of Torah. So I do want to thank you very much. And although I cannot promise ahead of time that my answers will be very good, but I do know from past experience that the questions will be excellent. So I guess we can start.
Okay. Should we start with the easy ones?
Yeah, I guess. Easy.
Rabbi, what's up with the black hats?
Yeah. You know, I will be honest with you and to say that to some degree, certain aspects of Judaism that are not absolutely essential have become exaggerated in their importance. In other words, a black hat, contrary to what you might hear, is not one of the 13 principles of faith. In fact, Maimonides probably wore a turban. I don't think he wore a black hat looking at the picture. However, the general idea, there are two general points to keep in mind. Number one, there are many views in the laws of prayer that say in particular that when a person should pray to God, they should be dressed in the manner that they would be dressed to appear before a king. Now, in the olden days, and by the olden days I mean before President John F. Kennedy, before 1960s, when you went to a formal event, you'd always come wearing a hat. A hat was part of standard gentlemanly attire. Now, there is indeed some question whether a hat should be so essential today, since hats are not commonly worn since JFK's administration. But one idea of the hat, the jacket, etc., is a way of being dignified in standing before the king. There is another aspect, which is more amorphous, but I think that's important as well, and that is whether you're part of a basketball, football, or baseball team, or whether you're a member of an army, there is a certain concept of sharing a certain uniform, because that shows which group of people do you identify with. There certainly is a concept, and I'm not saying it has to take particular forms, that if you're with the good guys or the good gals, you want to identify by the way you dress, so you kind of become part of that group. That gives a sense of group solidarity. It indicates a consistency of values. So the notion of the standard yeshiva costume of dark jacket, black hat, etc., is kind of a way of showing that different men are on the same team. And that is important as a way of giving people a sense of togetherness in a culture which largely disparages the study of Torah and the like. For women, there's a similar parallel. Of course, women have extra halachos simply because men are such a strong yetzer hara. Again, it's not because of women. It's because men, I don't want to say men are animals, but basically, men need to be protected from their baser impulses, and as a result, there are various laws regarding how women dress. So having said that, dress is important, but as I say, I would not say that the black hat is absolutely essential, but it is a way, number one, of identification. Number two, it's a way of showing honor to God in the course of tefillah. I should also mention there are certain Kabbalistic sources that indicate that one should pray to God with a double head covering. So hence, it's the kippah plus the hat. So there are different halachic sources that would indicate that it is desirable. But still, you have to keep it in perspective. If you have a black hat wearing person who has very bad personality characteristics and treats people rudely, he is putting his priorities in the wrong direction.
Okay. Rabbi, is it okay to smoke weed?
Well, if it's a dandelion weed, perfectly okay. Okay. Well, first of all, let's take cigarettes first, very, very quickly. Obviously, the Torah says we are obligated to safeguard our health because we are only able to keep the commandments and serve God if we have healthy bodies. And therefore, we are obligated to be careful about our diet. Again, I will confess I'm not always as careful, but nevertheless, one should be careful. One should regularly exercise. One should not do things that are injurious to their health, not because health is an end in and of itself, but as Maimonides writes, who was a very great doctor, as well as one of our greatest rabbis, it is only by preserving our body that we can nourish our soul by doing the commandments and the like. Now, seen in that way, the problem with drugs, even marijuana, which is a much milder drug than heroin and the like, is twofold. Number one, there is going to be a certain degree of impairment. Now, I know that the jury is out. There's all sorts of debates regarding whether the impairment is any worse than alcohol or tobacco, but even alcohol and tobacco, one has to be very, very careful about. And therefore, one really has to avoid anything that affects either their physical health or even worse, their mental health and their perception. Surveys do show that there can be kind of long-term motor impairment and even brain damage through the use of marijuana. But there are two other points to keep in mind as well. Even if we were to concede, and I'm not conceding this, that marijuana is innocuous, clearly it has consistently led to turning to harder drugs, such as heroin and cocaine. And let me just tell you, in my own community of Silver Spring, a very, very sweet, nice young man recently died of a heroin overdose. And it was a tremendous, tremendous tragedy, as you can imagine. And there's another issue as well, and that is, once you get involved in the drug culture, Who will be your friends? Who will you hang out to? In other words, it's not only the drug that'll be affecting you. It'll be the whole environment and the whole culture. So if you were to ask me in theory, does Jewish law categorically prohibit taking a single smoke of a marijuana cigarette? No, I'm not going to tell you that it's forbidden. But look what it leads to. Just like the potato chip, bet you can't eat one. Well, drugs is very much even more so. People cannot really be limited. There is too much of a history here. And one can never say, you know, I know when you're young, you think you're invulnerable. But as I say, I have recent examples that that's not the case. And to say that you can contain and restrict yourself when so many others have failed in that attempt should be a very, very sobering thought. So really, don't start on that path, because once you start, it's going to be a path of no return in which it's excruciatingly hard to try to control it and contain it. At this point, just don't get on that path at all.
Thank you. Rabbi, are we as Jews allowed to support stem cell research?
Yeah, well, that's a very, very interesting question. I assume that most of you know the technology of stem cells, in which, generally speaking, stem cells are undifferentiated cells that can be coaxed and nourished to turn into any one of the 200-plus types of cells in the body. So you could use stem cells to turn into kidney tissue, lung tissue, brain tissue, neural tissue, and the like. You could repair heart valves. Eventually, perhaps we could create whole organ systems from stem cells. Now, stem cells can be obtained from a variety of sources. There are stem cells in umbilical cord blood. There are stem cells in bone marrow. They are called adult stem cells. There is absolutely no problem with them. That is not the problem at all. I assume the questioner was focusing not on what are called adult stem cells, but stem cells that are obtained from early fertilized embryos. They're called embryonic stem cells, in which you have an embryo that is fertilized in a petri dish in vitro fertilization, and within 10 to 12 days from fertilization, the cells have not yet differentiated, and you can get the stem cells, and then you can coax them and culture them indefinitely. Now, the big issue, of course, is in order to get embryonic stem cells, you have to destroy a fertilized embryo. And the big halakhic question and the ethical question in society is, are you committing an abortion by terminating a fertilized embryo? Egg and sperm are in the petri dish. And we know, of course, Jewish law generally is very adverse to abortion. We are not the same as the Catholics. We do not treat abortion as the equivalent of murder. So it's not the same as murder, but nevertheless, it is prohibited unless the mother's life is in danger or the like. Now here, as I say, I'm not here to give you a direct psak on this, because a direct halachic decision, you know, I can talk to people privately. I will say as a general matter that the few writings that we have, we don't have a lot of written stuff on this, have tended to say that until the embryo is implanted in a woman's uterus, it is not yet in an environment where, if left alone, could turn into life. And as a result, the destruction of the unimplanted embryo for life-saving research would be halachically legitimated. However, because again, the prohibition of abortion is to destroy an embryo which, if left undisturbed, would be able to turn into a pregnancy. However, let me say this, that halacha probably would not endorse the deliberate creation of an embryo in order to destroy it. In other words, generally speaking, halacha would allow, Jewish law would allow, the obtaining of stem cells from embryos that were generated for fertility purposes, that the parties then decide to discard, but they would not allow to a deliberate creation in order to destroy. If you follow this debate for the past few years, you may recall that that was the position in the Clinton administration, in which so-called spare embryos could be used for stem cell research, but not research embryos. The Bush administration has a stricter view regarding this, but I think halacha would not have to be as strict as George W. Bush is at this point.
Thank you. Although we appreciate the clapping, in order for the sake of the time that we have, it's not necessary to clap until the very end if you feel so. Rabbi, was the Garden of Eden a real place? And if so, where is it?
Yes. You know, it's very, very interesting. The standards understanding of Jewish theology and thought is the Garden of Eden was a real place because it was the earth that it was on earth, and Adam and Eve were created from the earth and they were placed in the Garden of Eden. But basically, as a result of the sin, although the Bible describes them as being banished from the Garden of Eden, but the conventional understanding is that essentially the Garden of Eden was banished from earth. And essentially, it becomes the heavenly realm of Olam Haba, which means the world to come, which is the spiritual place where the soul is in communion with God. So the standard understanding is that Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, is generally understood today to be somewhat synonymous with the concept of the world to come, which is not a physical entity. However, let me point out that as great a thinker as Maimonides, in his introduction to the 11th parak of Sanhedrin, which is a tractate in the Talmud, states very, very specifically that Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, is a place, a physical place, that does exist on earth somewhere. And it is, now of course it's not really clear when we get to experience that, because Mashiach, the Messiah, will come and will be in Israel, and then when we die our souls go to Olam Haba, the world to come. So it's not clear where Gan Eden fits into this, but Maimonides does say it is a physical place. Where it is, I wish I knew. You know, maybe Sandy, maybe Catalina, I don't know, you know, but basically, we really don't know. We do know that even if it is a physical place, it is totally inaccessible to human beings until God gives us that reward, because the Torah describes the guardian angels that would prevent us from ever entering. So I do not know where it is. As I say, most authorities actually say it is not a place on earth right now, although it was a place.
Thank you. Rabbi, I've been told we should not get, for example, nose piercings, under the reason that we shouldn't do anything to make God's body ugly. But honestly, what if God made you ugly? If your appearance doesn't matter, why is it bad to make yourself ugly? And what if you don't consider piercing or tattoos to be ugly?
Yeah, there's actually a beautiful story in the Talmud. In fact, it's a very strange story in which a great rabbi remarked on a person how ugly he was. Again, it's very, very amazing how the rabbi remarked, and he realized later what a sin he committed, and he begged the person for forgiveness, and the person says, nope, ask the one who made me, ask his forgiveness, because when you insulted my looks, you were insulting the God who made me. Now, again, how that rabbi could say this is, I actually don't really have a good explanation, but the Talmud actually records the story, and the rabbi was crying and begging for forgiveness and the like. There are a few things to be said. First of all, there's no question, of course, if a person is a burn victim or suffered some accident or disfigurement, then of course one is allowed to have restoration. That's not the issue. The issue of cosmetic surgery pertains to people who don't have disfigurements or illness or burns, but they just want to look better. They want to have, first of all, you don't always look better with these things, and the like, the Botox injections or whatever it is. Now here, the idea is that when a person invests too much in how they look, then they're leading themselves to a more type of superficial existence. A person's beauty should be judged by their intelligence, by their character, by their kindness, by their goodness. And I think even at your age you could see that. Sometimes you could be with a person who may not be physically the most handsome or the most beautiful in the conventional way, but you like to be around them because there's so much warmth and vitality and friendliness. And then you have people that might be the like very icy people, people who are just cold and not caring, even if they might look conventionally beautiful. So the old saying, which is true, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. You know, it has a lot of truth there. And I think that if one just wants to improve their appearance, just because they're not happy with themselves. I think there's an underlying psychological and spiritual issue that needs to be explored. Why aren't I happy with myself? Why don't I see the good within me? Why don't I see what is special and unique and good about me? Because if you don't see it in yourself, other people are often not going to see it either, because these things become a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, there's an interesting discussion in the Talmud, you know, when a man and a woman get married, so there's a mitzvah, there's a divine commandment that we try to make the bride and the groom happy. So according to Beit Shammai, one of the scholars in the Talmud, if the bride is beautiful, we say how beautiful the bride is. If she's not so beautiful, we don't say how beautiful the bride is. Beit Hillel says, no, every bride is beautiful in her own way, and therefore we could say the same song. Now, let me just point out the following. If a person, however, is truly humiliated by their appearance, and they find it difficult to go out among people, then the halacha does permit cosmetic surgery for those types of reasons. I think we do have to differentiate between what you might call vanity surgeries, which halacha very much discourages, and surgeries that result from humiliation and embarrassment. That is a different type of situation. And although we would hope the person could deal with it, but nevertheless, if they really can't, halacha will give them that. Now, tattooing and body piercing, however, is generally considered to be forbidden, because generally speaking, there's no medical reason to do it. Piercing ears is interesting, though. Piercing ears, the custom is to be lenient, because the soft, fleshy part of the ear, you know, actually is not, the cartilage is not a permanent mutilation, because if you take out the earrings, you know, it eventually would close up. Even though then some people are strict on that too, the custom is to be lenient. But any type of permanent piercing is regarded as a mutilation. Tattoos are regarded as a disfigurement of the body. And in many ways, you're kind of making the statement, like this rabbi made to the ugly person, in which you're not happy with what God made. You want to change it. You want to make it better. And as I say, that not only reflects something negative to God, but it also reflects a negative self-image as well. We should concentrate on our souls, on our intelligence, on our personality, on our kindness, on our compassion. We should emphasize a little less the externals of our lives.
Rabbi, along the same lines, what are the parameters for plastic surgery in non-life-threatening situations?
Yeah, so I think that's my basic answer. My basic answer is that if there is disfigurement, even if it's not life-threatening, you can certainly correct it. If there is humiliation or embarrassment, even though you try to deal with that first as a psychological issue, but if you really feel that this inhibits you, this makes you ashamed to be seen with other people, then the halacha clearly does permit it. Let me mention, too, another type of surgery that has been legitimated, and that is gastric stapling surgery. You know, now it's very, very popular. It's kind of a relatively quickie way to lose a lot of weight.
Please explain what.
Well, that's kind of when they staple your stomach and the like, and people can lose like 100 pounds in 6 months or 3 months and the like, because simply the stomach can hold less food, so you know you're filled by eating very, very little. And although that is usually non-life-threatening condition, although obesity can be a life-threatening condition, but nevertheless, if a person has a problem controlling their weight, that is considered to be such a potentially serious health risk that the gastric stapling would be legitimate for there.
Thank you. Rabbi, I know it is against Jewish law to create graven images. Is it okay today to draw or sculpt human forms for art?
Yes, very, very excellent question, and it's not an easy question. Generally speaking, we are very, very strict regarding human sculpture. Human sculpture is not permissible, although if you do it in a more abstract type of way, as opposed to Michelangelo, let's say, that's kind of an abstract, like a slab of stone and another slab of stone, then it would be permitted. But if it actually has the human face in sculpture, we are very, very strict. On the other hand, when it comes to painting two-dimensional representations, there the halacha is much more lenient. In fact, let me tell you, there were some early authorities that even said you weren't allowed to own dolls, because dolls had, you know, human faces. And there's even a story, there was a great rabbi, the Chafetz Chaim, great, great, maybe you've heard of him, a very, very sainted rabbi who died in 1933. He was one of the great righteous people of the past 200 years. And his daughter tells the story that she once got a beautiful doll, and her father took a knife and kind of cut out its eye because he mutilated the image. And then he said, you know, you're not allowed to have a human image. And she was crying. The Chafetz Chaim was much more strict than many other authorities. But certainly a human sculpture is a difficult issue. And I don't want to give you too much information that you won't be able to carry out. But the truth is, one should be careful about not even owning human sculptures or sculptures of human figurines in their house.
Thank you. Rabbi, I'm in a vocal group. On concert days and dress rehearsals, during part of the concert we hold hands. We stand on risers in a stab format, sopranos, tenor, alto, bass, so it's boy, girl. When a person sings and speaks, their body vibrates, and when the group holds hands, it increases the vibrations and makes the singing more powerful in sound and portrays the song better. Yeah. This tradition of the group handholding is part of many professional choruses. Shomer Negiah, which is the guarding of the flesh, states guys and girls cannot touch each other. With both the tradition and scientific reason in mind, is it a violation of Shomer Negiah for me to sing in this fashion? Please explain.
Yes, it is. And actually, I think that the questioner articulated very eloquently exactly why it is a problem. The issue of Shomer Negiah, this is the issue of boys and girls, men and women, who are not married, not even physically touching, you know, not hugging, not holding hands, at least in a romantic way. That is because the attraction of men and women is very, very powerful attraction. God made us this way for very good reason, generally speaking, because God wants men and women to have deep and intimate relationships, which of course should be in the context of marriage. And therefore God made us with sexual urges, which are not just, you know, animal urges, but rather, you know, we want to be connected to each other in that way. Now, what I hear described here is the very, very moving power of music, and the notion that when we sing, we're engaged in a very spiritual endeavor. Now, music, the Vilna Gaon once wrote that music is the most spiritual power of the world other than Torah. Torah is the highest, and music is right under Torah. How music can move us. And there's no question, if I hold the hand of my partner, there's going to be an electricity that'll be connecting us. And that could very easily turn into, you know, improper, could lead to an improper connection. So the truth of the matter is, I would think that this would be exactly the type of thing that Negiah, sexual touching, is designed to prohibit. For example, let me distinguish it. That might be different, for example, than a gynecologist examining a patient. I think it's different than a physical therapist. Even though those are problems too, but I'm saying is there is a concept in Jewish law sometimes that for professional duties, the laws of Negiah don't apply because it's not likely or it's less likely to have a sexual energy attached to it. But in this type of artistic, emotional expressiveness, I think there's very much going to be a sexual energy and component. And therefore, I would think that Negiah would, in fact, be a problem here. Of course, there's another problem, too, with men and women singing, but I'll just answer the question I presented.
Rabbi, how do we understand people living 930, 600, or even 175 years in biblical times? It seems to make the biblical stories a little bit less realistic. Was it true, and why don't we live that long now?
Well, it is a very, very good question. Whether those are meant to be totally literally, there is some discussion. in which various intermediate generations might be omitted from the calculus of the Torah. Certainly, the 10 generations that, you know, there were 10 generations between Adam and Noah, right? Adam is number one, Noah is number 10. Certainly, anything that happened before the flood was a totally different world. In fact, many of the basic foundations of the laws of chemistry and physics were very, very different. That's why the age of the earth gets totally thrown off. The seasons were different. The earth's orientation was different. So consequently, the potential for immensely long life before the flood is not at all beyond the possibility of imagination, because the whole structure of the universe and the scientific laws of the universe could have been fundamentally altered by virtue of the flood. Now, even today, scientists are actually exploring whether there is any automatic termination of life. In other words, is death as a biological, physiological event inevitable? Or is it always a function of disease or degeneration? And there is some discussion whether immortality is in fact a medical possibility. I mean, let me point out that we live in a world of environmental toxins. We live in a world of pollutants. We live in a world of food additives. We live in a world of sin as well. And both the spiritual and the physical ills of this world do have a, obesity as well, all have an effect on life expectancies. So even though it's something that you've never heard of, somebody living 900 years, the fact that it doesn't happen today does not mean that it could not have happened in the past. But as I say, there is some discussion in literature whether, since the Torah is perhaps not mentioning all of the generations, is only mentioning the important people, so the Torah is considering all those years to belong to a given person. Meaning one possible way of looking at it, if this makes it easier for you, is if person A, let's say, had a son and a grandson and a great-grandson and a great-great-grandson, but they didn't do anything important, we might in effect say person A's life encompassed all of those lives. I mean, that might be the simplest way of looking at it. But it is an approach that some take, but it is not the mainstream approach. The mainstream approach is that these are taken in a literal way.
Thank you. Rabbi, why do some really Orthodox Jews deny the existence of the State of Israel, and even some align themselves with Holocaust deniers, as we've seen recently?
Yes. That was really a very, very awful thing. Let me just hasten to add, however, that even those Jews who participated in the Holocaust denial conference in Iran did make a statement at the conference that, of course, there was a Holocaust and their own relatives died in the Holocaust. I mean, they did make a point that they were not in agreement with whatever the Iranian guy was saying, but their position was they didn't want the Holocaust to be an excuse for what they regarded as the unjust existence of the State of Israel. That itself is pretty awful, but nevertheless, they were not, God forbid, Holocaust deniers. And many of the even ultra-Orthodox, so to speak, excommunicated these people for participating. But the issue about the State of Israel is the following. There is a relatively small group, and it's not a large group, who believe, and they actually have some Talmudic sources, this is not a totally ignorant approach, that because God destroyed the temple, and because God mandated that the Jewish people be in exile, we are obligated to accept exile as our fate until such time as God summons us home by the bringing of the Messiah in a miraculous way. And therefore, they see it as a rebellion against God to establish a Jewish political state before the advent of the coming of the Mashiach. Let me emphasize, according to this, it is not only the fact that the State of Israel itself is a secular state. Rather, their position is, even if the State of Israel would be governed by rabbis and Jewish law and everything else, even if it would be a religious state, it would be anti-religious, because we're not allowed to contravene God's decree of the galut, of the exile, and the like. Their stance, to use a fancy term, could be described as theological quiescence. Quiescence is the state of being passive in the face of the divine decree. Now, I will point out that that position is very problematical because, for example, if we're sick, we don't take the position, well, God must have made me sick, so I'm not going to go to a doctor. Rather, God, as the saying goes, God wants us to engage in natural means to ameliorate our condition, having faith, of course, that God is the one that blesses us. Well, one could take the same position politically, that yes, we're in the diaspora, we're in the exile, but God wants us to try to improve our situation. But nevertheless, let me point out the following. When Theodor Herzl, of course, Jews have been praying for the Jewish state, there are thousands and thousands of years. But when Theodor Herzl implemented the modern movement of political Zionism in the 1890s, he envisioned political Zionism as a solution to anti-Semitism. His position was, if only the Jews would have their own states, nobody would hate us anymore. We would be accepted like everybody else. Well, if one has to be honest, as much as we love and cherish and pray for the welfare of the State of Israel, the one thing the State of Israel has not successfully done is eliminate hatred for the Jewish people. And if anything, we see in this modern day and age that if anything, the existence of the State of Israel has perhaps increased a hatred for Jews. So all of this feeds into their idea, which I do not endorse, by the way. So their idea that we would have been better off without a state of Israel. But it is, I think, a minority position. It is not a mainstream within the Torah camp.
Thank you. Rabbi, if one is a secular Jew and does not believe in becoming Orthodox and changing one's life for God, but does believe in God and his creation of the world, is that person sinning?
Well, you know, all of us sin. I mean, you know, King Solomon, who was the wisest of all people, although he had some marriage problems, King Solomon says in the book of Ecclesiastes that there is no person who is so righteous that he doesn't sin. So, yeah, that person is sinning, but, you know, I'm sinning, and all of us are sinning as well. Certainly, believing in God is a tremendous step of the way in the right direction, meaning it counts for an awful, awful lot. The difference between a believer and a non-believer is a pretty, pretty big chasm. And thankfully, if you've managed to jump over that chasm, you're well on the way to doing what God wants you to do with your life. However, keep in mind that once you believe that there is a God, you immediately have the second question: why did God create me? And what does God want from me? Is it plausible God just created me and then just forgot about me and doesn't care? And that's when Torah comes in, and you got to explore that, because this is the big issue. If I believe in God, I believe my creation has a purpose. And if my creation has a purpose, I got to find out what is that purpose. And that's where the Torah comes in. So you got to keep on exploring. So the issue is not to look down at anybody. Nobody should look down at someone who's not perfect, because who's ever doing the looking down is not perfect either. But the most important thing is not where we are in this movement to God, but in what direction we're going. If you're a seeker, and I want to say, anyone that is here is by definition somebody who is very serious about looking for the truth. So if you're a seeker, we're all moving in the same direction. Some are a little ahead of each other. But this is like a marathon. You're only running against yourself. You're not racing with anybody else or against anybody else. But you're moving on your own pace. And God willing, you will find the truth. You will find the path of life that God wants you to have.
Thank you. Rabbi, I'm a Jewish teenager. Many of my friends come from dysfunctional families. The parents fight, are separated, or even abusive. I find it hard to understand how God can bring a child into a world without providing for them the fundamental family structure. How does this child or a teenager have a fighting chance?
Yeah, well, again, I see from the question a person of deep sensitivity and compassion, and I hope that you can use that sensitivity and compassion to bring hope and comfort and support to the very souls that are in pain that you've described so eloquently. If you think about it, though, this is really a question about evil and suffering generally. Why did 1.5 million children die in the Holocaust? Why did 6 million Jews die in the Holocaust? Why did hundreds of thousands die in a tsunami? And why did thousands die in Hurricane Katrina or lose their homes and the like? If God is just and God is benevolent and God is kind and God is merciful, then how could God create a world where people suffer? And you're right, it can't be because of sins, because these are kids who are born into a family where they don't seem to have a chance at all. But the answer is, I mean, I don't have the answer, but one point to consider is this. God has given us a tremendous gift in our personalities, and that's the gift of resilience. Social psychologists are analyzing the phenomenon of resilience. By resilience, I mean, how come you take kids who grew up in the worst conditions, and some kids become the drug addicts and go to jail and die young, and other kids like Dr. Benjamin Carson, who's the black head of neurosurgery in Johns Hopkins University, and he grew up in a gang, and he became, you know, one of the most prominent physicians in the world, not even Jewish, so I'm not giving you a non-Jewish example. And they want to know, what's the secret? Why do some kids make it and some kids don't make it? Because if we knew the secret, we could bottle it up. And the short answer that the research demonstrates is that if there's even one adult figure in their life, it doesn't even have to be a father or a mother. It might be a grandparent, it might be an uncle, it might be a teacher. It might be a big brother-sister type of mentor. That can make all the difference in the world. Because there's so much potential in a human soul yearning to come out. And if they get some validation and some acceptance, they will flourish like a flower that you plant in manure. Out of the manure, the fertilizer, can come the most beautiful, beautiful flower. So the point of the matter is, everybody has a chance. And we gotta seek them out and give them that chance. Because that chance is there. It can be. Nobody's in a hopeless situation. There is always hope. Now, but then the question becomes, but why did God make it so difficult? Well, many of you may have heard of Viktor Frankl, who was a famous psychoanalyst. He died a few years ago. He was Jewish, although he was not religious, but he didn't have Jewish education. But he was, I would call, a spiritual intuitive, because much of his teachings that he developed on his own are actually the Torah's teachings. He came to it on his own. So he really is kind of a spiritual genius in this way. And he talked about the idea that sometimes it is our confrontation with difficulty and adversity that makes us into the sensitive, great people we're capable of becoming. That precisely the person who suffers rejection can develop compassion and insight in which they can help people. And the person who doesn't have those challenges will never develop those qualities. It's an irony and a paradox of reality that sometimes out of the greatest evil comes the greatest goodness. And without that evil and without that adversity and without that frustration, people would just not develop in the way that they're capable of developing. Does it always work? No, it doesn't always work, because there are going to be casualties. Just as the old saying goes, God never gives you a test that you cannot pass. But I would add, God never gives you a guaranteed pass either. Meaning in every test, we could fail. But there is that potential for passing. And if you haven't read it, I urge you to all read A Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, in which he develops this notion of we don't have a choice over the externals of our life. But our choice in life is, how do I respond to the situation that I'm in? And even in a concentration camp, and he was in the concentration camp, he demonstrates choices can be made. And that is really our responsibility in life. I'll give you another non-Jewish example, Christopher Reeve. Think about him. Superman. And yet, he said before he died that although he would not wish his accident on anybody, he is happier with the person he was after the accident than the person he was before the accident. A remarkable statement.
Thank you. Rabbi, when two people get divorced, does that mean they were never soulmates?
Absolutely not. We really can't always predict it. But you know, sometimes somebody could be your soulmate with the intention that it was a necessary state in your spiritual development that you needed to go through. You needed to be with that person and vice versa to work something out within your own personality. Now, we don't always do that successfully. But the point is, even when people get divorced, there is something they should have gained from that relationship. Very often they don't, I admit that. And therefore, the concept of divorce is not incompatible with somebody being the right person for you at that time. And of course, let me point out too, that sometimes a divorce might mean that the parties didn't work out what they should have worked out, meaning they're leaving their soulmate because whatever it is, they're unwilling or unable to work out the issue. But even if the marriage is absolutely doomed, that still does not mean it was without value. There are things we learn from them, which is why you will sometimes find that people might do well in a second marriage, but it's because of the process they went through in the first marriage. And therefore, that is something of value.
Thank you. Rabbi, why are fingernails so significant, i.e., we are careful to throw them out when we cut them, and we look into them at Havdalah, when Shabbat goes out?
Yes, it is interesting. Some of these are in the realm of mysticism. We don't fully understand this. The one tradition I can share with you is, if you recall, after the after Adam and Eve ate from the fruits in the tree of knowledge, and they were expelled from the Garden of Eden, and they were aware of their nakedness. So it says that God made them special garments to cover them up. And there's a bit of a pun here. The Torah says the word kosnos or, which means garments of light, but or with a different letter, ayin, means hide or skin. And some interpret, some midrashim, some rabbinic statements interpret that they were encased with a fingernail-like translucent substance that covered their body. And then later, it just got removed to the fingertips. But these fingernails, therefore, are a remnant of the original garments of light that God encased us. And therefore, when we look at our fingernails, we are reminded of the gift that God has given us. And perhaps we might connect it to Shabbos as well, because Shabbos is the great gift of the extra soul. And as we leave Shabbos, we look at the fingernail to remind us that God has given us many, many gifts, and we have to be worthy of using them and benefiting from them. Now, Kabbalistically, actually, the Talmud itself mentions this. There are certain dangers that are associated with discarding fingernails. It says, for example, if a pregnant woman walks over fingernails on the street, God forbid, there could be miscarriages and the like. We don't totally understand why that is so, but that is why there is a special set of laws regarding the discarding of fingernails, that the Talmud actually says the best thing to do is to burn them, the second best thing to do is to bury them, or even throwing them in the garbage would be okay, but one does not simply throw them on the floor, which wouldn't be nice anyway. But there is a fear of the pregnant woman walking over them and the like.
Thank you. Rabbi, what is the difference between Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox conversion? And why doesn't Orthodox conversion recognize the other two?
Yes, well, it's really very, very simple. In order for a conversion to Judaism to be valid, there are three steps that have to be taken for a man and two steps for a woman. The three steps for a man is circumcision, if he didn't have a bris as a child. If he had a non-Jewish super circumcision, you would kind of pinprick a little spot of blood. Then immersion in a mikveh, which is a special ritual pool. In fact, the Christian ritual of baptism is modeled after the Jewish ritual of mikveh. But the third is the most important, and that is a commitment to abide by the commandments of the Torah and live your life in accordance with Jewish law. Now, keep in mind, if somebody wants to become a citizen of the United States, you cannot become a citizen of the United States unless you swear allegiance to the Constitution of the United States. Now, a natural-born citizen doesn't have to take that oath, although they're supposed to keep the Constitution. So you may say, well, gee, why, if I want to convert, why do I have to make all of these promises if, you know, my next-door neighbor doesn't have to do so? Well, once again, it's the same idea. If you're naturally born Jewish, you're Jewish whether you accept it or not, although you're supposed to accept it, obviously. So consequently, the problem fundamentally with a reform and conservative conversion is not a political issue, but it's simply this. The reform movement does not require obedience to Jewish law at all. The word halakha, halakha is a technical term for traditional Jewish law. If you will ask a reform rabbi, does your movement subscribe to the binding nature of halakha? The official answer of the movement is no, and I'm not exaggerating at all. Now, conservative is a little more controversial. Because if you were to ask a conservative rabbi, do you believe in the binding nature of halakha, they will say yes. However, their understanding of the halachic process is so fundamentally different in terms of the ability to change the rules. For example, the conservative movement a few weeks ago legitimated gay marriage. In the past, they permitted over dissent. I understand over dissent. Yeah, I understand. I know Rabbi Roth, Joel Roth, very well. And in the past, they permitted driving on Shabbos. Now, again, I'm not here to criticize them. I'm just saying that these are judgments, however, which, under the traditional understanding of halacha, are not halacha. Therefore, a conservative reform conversion would not be accepted by the Orthodox, even if there is circumcision and immersion in a mikveh, because there was not the acceptance of the halachic system. Now, the good news is, of course, the good news is that you can always upgrade, so to speak, meaning to say there are people that have had several conversions, reform, conservative, orthodox, then multiple levels of orthodox, ultra-orthodox, Hasidic, etc., meaning the gate is never closed. As each, if you want to advance in your level of observance as a Jew who chooses Judaism, one can always go further and further in that way. So the issue is not political. The issue is really not political. The issue is this third element, acceptance of halakha, Jewish law, as binding.
Thank you. Rabbi, I've heard that one has to wait 6 hours after eating meat before they can eat milk. If a man and a woman keep kosher and they both wait 6 hours, what would happen if the man eats meat and the woman eats dairy? Can they kiss within 6 hours? I just asked the questions.
The thought that occurs to me, maybe I don't want to say it, depends how they kiss, but the thing is, technically it would be
proper. Everyone just woke up.
It would be proper to wipe their lips. In other words, wash your lips off from any residue of the meat and the milk, and then kiss. Assuming, of course, that you're husband and wife, you're married to each other. Yeah. But you should wipe your lips off just to be sure they're clean.
Yeah. Thank you. Why are boys allowed to sing in front of girls, but girls can't sing in front of boys?
Because women have superior self-control and inner discipline. Boys do not have. It's 100% true that these are generalizations. I don't mean to say every single boy is this way and every single, in other words, but obviously the halachic system is based on the norms of society. And also I would say too that by and large, a woman's voice is considered to be more sexually stimulating and attractive than a boy's voice. Again, these are generalizations, but the halacha is based on this typical type of pattern that exist. Remember, the laws of Kol Isha, of women singing, are really based on the sexually exciting effect that it will have on the male audience. And that's really what the halacha is ultimately based on here.
Question related to the previous question. Is hearing a woman's voice recorded, i.e. on an iPod or a stereo, also considered a problem of hearing a woman's voice?
Yeah, these are different opinions. In other words, as I say, I'm not here to give you a definitive resolution on controversial issues. There are certainly some opinions that do say that listening to a recording of a woman's voice, if there's no video connected to it, and you don't, especially if you don't know how the woman looks, that's another thing, and you don't know, you've never seen the woman singer before, there are some opinions that would permit it. Other opinions would be very strict. So it is a matter of debate about radios, iPods, etc. On the other hand, when there is a video attached, such as a movie, so people are a bit stricter there. Although even then, some people are lenient. So the issue of Kol Isha, a woman singing, is a controversial issue. Well, controversial in the sense that there are many, many different configurations. What if men and women are singing together? What if more than one woman is singing? What if it's Shabbat Semirot, songs of Shabbat, etc.? And, you know, NCSY has a tradition of liberality because we want to encourage people to enjoy the Shabbos by music and the like. But these are complex and controversial issues for which I cannot say there's a definitive consensus. Different people go different ways on some of these. Now, again, I want to point out, just so to be sure you don't misunderstand me, when I say different people go different ways, I don't want you to envision this as somebody gets up in the morning and says, oh, I'm going to be strict or I'm going to be easy. Rather, everything does go back to looking at Talmudic texts and looking at precedents and looking at earlier authorities. It is a question of scholarship, analysis, and working out all of the halachic approaches. It is not an arbitrary thing. But having said that, there will be areas in which different great rabbis will have different opinions.
Thank you. Rabbi, I understand it says in the Torah that male homosexuality is an abomination. What is the Torah approach towards female homosexuality?
Yes. These are very, very good questions. It is clear that female homosexuality or female expression of homosexuality is not of the same severity. That's 100% true. It is not of the same condemnation as the male homosexual sexual activity. Nevertheless, it is regarded, the Talmud discusses it, it is regarded as an improper misuse of sexual arousal. Really of the same nature as self-stimulation, which is not regarded as that proper. And ultimately, the reasons are really the same. And that is, God gave us sexuality as a way of establishing families and as a way of creating marriages, a way of having children, and the like. And any misuse of the sexual impulse is considered to be a misuse of that function. In some ways, I want to say, in a sociological way, female homosexuality can even be worse in the following way. Many lesbians are lesbians by choice. In other words, the issue of conscious choices are actually more prevalent in the female community than perhaps they might be in the male community. In other words, women could go either way on this. And consequently, obviously, when people make choices not to pursue the avenue the Torah wants, that in many ways is worse than people who are programmed in a certain way and find it very, very difficult to make.
Maintain friendships without alienating my friends.
Yeah, this is a great question. You know, in the 1930s, they had a survey of the major problems in the public school system. And the number one problem was excessive talking in class, and the number two problem was spitballs. They did the same survey in the 1980s, and the number one problem was guns, and after that were drugs, and then rape. You know, so obviously, problems have gotten a bit more serious. But the truth of the matter is, even if you're in a good public school, where, you know, you don't have rape, you don't have guns, etc. But certainly, you know, drugs you're going to have. You're going to have premarital sexual intercourse and the like. And you're going to be dealing with, even with language, profanity and the like, you'll be dealing with all sorts of values that are very much against the Torah. First of all, let me say that being in public school is a very, very difficult challenge. And anyone who can stay religiously Jewish and committed in that type of environment really deserves a tremendous amount of credit. And, you know, we're really very, very proud of a person's ability to persevere in that particular environment. Number one, you have a tremendous opportunity to show that you can stand up for what you believe in, even if people think that you're crazy. And people will ultimately respect you for it. They will respect you because you have the courage of your convictions and you don't simply go along with whatever the prevailing trend is. You can make what is called in our literature a Kiddush Hashem. That means you will glorify the name of God. People will see you and say, if that's the way a Jew behaves, these Jews are pretty good people. And you can make that impression on non-Jews, and you can make that impression on Jews, which is even better. By all means, be friendly, be open, be welcoming, but pick your friends. Try to find people that have moral principles. There are non-Jews that are moral people. We believe that that's certainly possible. You don't have to hang around with degenerate people or people that are, cool, but they're not living by moral standards. Number one, pick your friends. And number two, know that you have to have boundaries. That, you know, I'm your friend and I'm your buddy and we can have good times together, but there's a part of me I'm not going to give to you. And, you know, I know that's a little bit of a hardship, but you got to hold back. You can't go all the way in places that'll take you into a bad place. And if you're able to keep your values, sanctify God's name, don't simply give in to peer pressure, you are really doing a tremendous accomplishment. And that's going to really serve you well in adulthood.
Thank you. Rabbi, can I or can I not have an organ donor symbol on my license? Why or why not?
Yep, excellent, excellent question. I have, you may want to check, there's a website, Halachic Organ Donor Society, that's HODS.org, and you'll see many, many articles, and I have two or three articles there myself on this. The problem with organ donors is not what people think. A lot of people think, oh, you're not allowed to desecrate a dead body, and if you desecrate a dead body, there's not going to be resurrection of the dead. That's not really the problem. Because to save a life, you're allowed to cut into a body. You're allowed to take something from a dead body to save a person that's alive. You know what the problem is? The problem is that vital organs like hearts and lungs and livers are taken from people who are declared brain dead. Now let me explain that. The old definition of death was both your heart stopped beating and you stop breathing, so your brain, you know, there was no respiratory function controlled by the brain. The problem is, if you wait until the heart stops beating, the heart deteriorates almost immediately, and it's not suitable for transplantation. So in the 1960s, when Dr. Christian Barnard developed the heart transplants in South Africa, the laws of most of the world were changed to redefine death. And death, let's say in the United States, in all 50 states, now means if there's a diagnosis that your brain, it doesn't mean being in a coma, Terry Shiver was alive, but if the brain stem is dead. Now the brain stem being dead means that any respiration is maintained only artificially by a respirator. Even though because of that respirator your heart is beating normally and pumping blood, we can cut into that person and take out the heart. The halachic debate, which is a major debate, is a person whose brain is destroyed, but whose heart is beating through artificial respiration, is that person dead or alive? Many great rabbis take the position that person is alive. And when you cut into that body, you are murdering a person to save somebody else. Now, other rabbis, Rabbi Moshe Tendler, who's a professor, both a rabbi and a professor of biology at Yeshiva University, takes the position that when the brain is destroyed, the person is dead. and you're allowed to cut in. So it is an argument. My own view is, if you ask me, is that I don't think the halacha does permit the donation of organs, but there are many other rabbis who take a different position. You need to talk to your rabbi, check out the Halachic Organ Donor Society website, and the like. But I just want to make clear to you, the issue is not cutting into a dead body. If you could get a heart from a dead body, go ahead and do it. The problem is there is some uncertainty. When is a person dead? Is a person dead only when the heart stops beating, in which case it's too late for a transplantation? Or is a person dead when the brain is no longer functioning? And there's also a lot of debate, by the way, if brain death is really death. Because keep in mind, people who are clinically brain dead still have body temperature. And you're wondering, well, if the brain is dead, why isn't the body cold? People who have been brain dead, pregnant women, have carried babies to term. Can a cadaver continue a pregnancy? You know, so one has to wonder whether brain death is in fact death. But that's the question.
Thank you. Rabbi, why do women cover their hair after they're married? If hair is sexually attractive, it'll be sexually attractive before marriage as well.
Yes, this is fascinating. This is the only law of modesty in dress that is different for a married woman than a single woman. Every other law is the same in terms of how you dress. We never say married women got to dress one way and single women have to dress another way. The only difference is the covering of hair. And let me add a little question to the question, and that is, well, you know, a lot of married women might wear very beautiful wigs of human hair. And those beautiful wigs of human hair are, you know, more beautiful perhaps than their natural hair. And if the whole issue is not to be sexually alluring, why do we allow that? So one answer would be the following. One answer would be that a woman who's not married is allowed to have her hair uncovered because that particular measure of attractiveness will make her attractive to a marriage partner. In other words, we want to be able to have a symbol as to whether she is taken or whether she's still available. It is a sign of availability. But another issue as well is this. A person's hair, a woman's hair in particular, is said to be an expression of her individuality and her personality. It's not just a regular physical feature. It's more of an expression of a person. And when a person is ready to be married and establish a household, so the energies of individuality and personality should be focused in the creation of the home and family life as opposed to be indiscriminately available to everybody out there. And therefore, the suggestion might be this. A married woman covering her hair is not so much to prevent other people from thinking about her, because after all, the human hair wig might be more beautiful. But it's really a reminder to herself that she needs to be a bit more contained, a bit more reticent, a bit more private, a bit more focused. In other words, it's much more of an internal reminder as opposed to an external situation. Meaning even if people don't know that your hair is covered, the main point is that you know that your hair is covered, and therefore it's a reminder of a certain sense of privacy and reticence in terms of your interactions with others. Let me just say quickly, to digress for a moment. You know, in the workplace today, we have all these laws about sexual harassment. This is a big, big issue in the workplace. And many businesses now have employee manuals that talk about how men and women should interact. And it's amazing. A modern employment manual sounds like the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law of 500 years ago. When you are talking to a woman in the office, the door should be open. It is proper that, you know, there should be, you shouldn't be alone, etc. Avoid improper touching that connotes too much affection. You know, there actually are these laws because it is understood that when boundaries break down, even if they seem innocuous, lines could be crossed that might be very, very bad. And it's interesting that it took society a few hundred years, perhaps, to realize what essentially was in our tradition.
Thank you. We have a few more moments. Why is it that one's Jewishness is defined by one's mother and not one's father?
Yes, again, a very, very excellent question. As you know, the Reform movement itself basically does allow Jewish identity to be established either matrilineally or patrilineally, which is, again, one of the reasons why we can't accept the Reform definition of... Not only don't we accept Reform conversions, we can't accept the definition of Jewish by birth either, because Judaism and our tradition is based exclusively on the mother. This is derived from biblical verses. This is actually the interpretation of verses in the book of Deuteronomy. It is also seen in the book of Ezra. I see for some reason there's a book of Ezra in the back of the room here. Ezra was the great spiritual leader who brought the Jews back from Babylonia to Israel. And Ezra was involved in the building, he came a little after the building of the second temple. And if you ever read the book of Ezra, you will actually discover that there were many Jews who married Canaanite women and had children from those Canaanite women. And it is said that Ezra made them divorce those women and send away the children, which indicates the children were not Jewish, because they came from non-Jewish women. So clearly, the idea that this is a later rabbinic invention is not true. We see it in the Bible itself, absolutely, that Jewish identity is based on the mother. I was going to say. Now, the reason for that is not entirely clear. One reason is you can always know who somebody's mother is, but before DNA testing, you could not really know who somebody's father was. If a woman, let's say, was promiscuous or had several people she was with, so we know the baby came out of her womb, but we don't know from which father, and consequently, maternity was considered to be a more reliable indicator of identity than was paternity. The other reason might be a more spiritual, mystical reason, and that is, a developing child obviously has a stronger physical bond with the mother because it was with the mother for 9 months. The father's contribution was very fleeting and ephemeral. And we believe that gestation and pregnancy are also spiritual processes which implant certain ideas of holiness in the soul. And therefore, only the child that was gestated in a Jewish mother was born with a Jewish soul. Now, someone who's not Jewish can become Jewish with conversion and get a Jewish soul, so to speak. But to acquire the soul by birth requires a gestational process.
Thank you. Final question. Rabbi, how do I know the Torah was written by God while the New Testament and Quran were not? Isn't it contradictory to say that we're right and they're wrong when they also use the same type of proof to show that their books are divine?
Yes. Well, again, you know, there is a seminar that is devoted almost entirely to this topic. This is a seminar that's called the Discovery Program of Eish HaTorah. And I would urge you to really spend a weekend. They offer it all over the place, wherever you live. They probably have a discovery program. But let me just give you Maimonides' argument, which is really Rav Yehuda Halevi said the same thing earlier. That is, Judaism does make a unique claim. In other words, it's not really the same, it's not really accurate to say, well, we say something and Christianity says something and Islam says something. We say something that no other religion says. For example, we make the claim that the entire Jewish nation, 600,000 men from the age of 20, and if you include the women and you include the children, you are dealing with a population of 3 million people or more. 3 million people heard God give us the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai and heard God declare, essentially, that Moses is his definitive prophet. Now, here's the question. Even Christianity concedes that that event happened. Even Islam concedes that that event happened, right? Because they just say it was superseded later. If you believe it didn't happen, you have to answer a question. How do you make up that type of lie? And who's going to be taken in? You see, every other religion fundamentally claims a revelation that was fundamentally private. Even the miracles of Jesus were done in front of a relatively small group of people. Now, it's possible for me to come to you and say, if you believe me, and say, I did a miracle or I saw a miracle, and then people believe it. They believe that a miracle happened in front of 20 people or 100 people. But how do you convince 3 million people overnight that something happened? The very implausibility of that story being made up lends a certain credence to its truth. In other words, check it. There is no other religion that claims mass revelation. All religions claim revelation to small numbers of righteous people. How many people saw Jesus rise from the tomb? Well, of course, I believe nobody saw Jesus rise from the tomb, but how many people say that they saw Jesus rise from the tomb? Not too many. Like less than 10 people, basically. I mean, you have, you have Paul, you have a few people. There was no claim that Jesus rose in front of the tomb in front of millions of people. We claim God revealed himself on Mount Sinai to 3 million people. And the Kuzari says that is not a falsifiable type of claim because there's no way that lie could be introduced and people would accept that particular situation.
Rabbi Breidowitz, with dignity, clarity, and Torah knowledge, you have successfully responded to over 30 questions. We thank you so much for your time and for your insights.